before, because that's where you start with the Malia, the Leilani, and the Hakina. Hanakioki was the only canoe that, as far as I can understand, that was the only canoe that was used for racing. But from Billy Cook, his standpoint from 1934 on, that they only use the Leilani and the Hakina. So, and the Hanakioki was used for training. Now,
all of these things, I don't know. Yeah. That's why I say, why am I here?
Well, because
I asked you to be here.
Yeah. Because you'll substantiate and help George in the 50s, because they're, you know, George will take the Leilani and the Kakina and the Malia, you know, as far as a koa, you know, all that between the 40s and the 50s, and you can find out the, you know, how they originated and you know, how it came about, where they got to the outrigger, how they came to surf club. And
can I simplify something while I'm talking? You guys can be thinking, because this is the first time I have some chance to have somebody put it down in writing. If you don't mind my doing this, because it's a sad, sad situation. When I became a member of the board of directors in 1960, well, my dad was here, and I grew up from the time 1946 with all of these boats, which I didn't know much about. But the Hanakioki was the one that was hanging in the back. It was our old boat. Everybody understood that. When, I think it was 1961 or 62, when Harry Field decided to start a club in Kahului, he appealed to the Otteri Canoe Club for a loan of the Hanakioki. And I, being the youngest member of the board, the board was inclined to go along with that. I, being the secretary or the vice president or whatever, was charged with putting together a history, cold turkey, of the Hanakioki. Fortunately, we still had Dad Center, Joe Stickney, Roland, Captain Roland, forget his name, I'll remember it, Edric Cook, Bowers, what's his name, Laura Bars, Vicky Bowers' father. These are all guys that, as young kids, had paddled the Hanakioki. And Dad knew all about the history of it. And the whole idea was to put together a history of the Hanakioki. As a matter of fact, this came as a result of the request from Harry Field. I did this, and all I did was the guy that was the pencil and paper interviewing and documenting. It went up with the canoe. Harry used it in whatever ceremonies took place there. I've heard a lot of stories amongst you guys what took place at Kahului. This all went place. I remember one where the boat went down and they needed somebody on the other end, and Harry
walked on.
As strong as he was, like an ox, could lift half the canoe by himself. Eventually we got the Hanakioki back. And I think you were, George Downing, was one that helped fix it up again so that it could be used in one of the, I think, didn't we loan it to one of the beach boys, or I forget.
The Waikiki beach boys used it at Molokai.
I forget.
They did. They used it in 1960.
60. 1960.
They used it against us when we were in the Leilani.
Yeah.
That is
back.
Exactly right.
And you busted your Okoli all night for two nights to fix that boat so that
was
those guys could use the boat. But anyway, to go ahead now, the boat had cracks in it. And what was the year they had the movie Hawaii? filming done at...
Well, there were two segments, so there was...
Well, this is down at...
One was pre-68.
Kind of Point?
Yeah, just this side. Makua, right on the beach at Makua. Much of the filming took place for the movie Hawaii. And this is, oh, I know, it's 1965. By now, I'm not the president of the club anymore, I'm the club captain. One day, I get a call from Tommy Arnott, vice president of the club. Boy, I get my Okoli ripped up and down. Why? What do you call me? Glad you know what? Who gave people permission to take the Hanakioki to Makua? It's down there. It's being rented. It's a commercial venture. I said, hey, I don't know anything about that. In fact, I don't believe it at all. Why don't you call down somebody at the Advocate Canoe Club and ask the manager if you can just go out and check and see if the boat's hanging. They go out, the boat is hanging. What has happened is some know-it-all, I don't know what it is, but I suspect it, took a cursory visit down there, saw a boat, and he says, that's the Hanakioki. I wonder if the Abidjan Canoe Club knows about that. Check with Klein Man, he probably did that. Well, to make a long story short, it wasn't the Hanakioki. The Hanakioki is still hanging up there. But what it was the White Horse. Because...
What?
The White Horse.
From Huinola.
Oh. And what happened was that wasn't Rabbit, one of the young guys that used to be on the beach here, Pat Kiabi, what was his last name? He was the representative of Huinola at the HCRA. Pat, hell of a nice guy, handsome kid. All of a sudden, Huinola decides they're going to have their first meeting in May, early May. They go down to have their meeting at the Alawai, and all of a sudden, no more the White Horse. And where is the White Horse? And why is the White Horse down there? A few of the key Kahanamokus had taken that boat and tied it up with a lease arrangement with whoever the producer or what he was. And that was a scandal. Okay, so Huinola doesn't even have a boat. They're going to go in the first race at Kailua. As it turned out, the wind is going about 50 miles an hour. I don't know that you were part of this, but we helped them take this boat down, this leaky boat down. The Hanakioki. Oh. They appealed to the Advocate Canoe. Can we borrow what we can't even get in the first race? They had to get loaned up to them. They had to fix it up overnight practically. There were cracks. Because by the time they got down to where they towed it, the thing was almost full of water. Lord Blears was the club captain of Huinola. To make a long story short, when we get down on the first race of the year, the wind is blowing a gale, and it favored a heavy boat, you know, glider. When you're going up against the wind and you got enough muscle, it goes, and when you come down, it goes. The boat was a jab. I'll never forget that. Two things, that the Hanakioki could do it under certain circumstances, and whoever the tattletale was that blamed the club captain of the Outer Canoe Club for loaning out the Kiwi down there, and it turned out backfired. It was one of the things. I think it was Louis Kahanamoku had made a deal. No, I think it was Sam. Sam was still living. Made a deal. I don't know why they thought they had the ownership, because Ine McKinney has had the title of that board all these years, as I understand it. How they could do that, I'll never know. It was a scandal.
Own the Hanakioki.
Oh, the White Horse. Why they could do that. But you see, the White Horse was not used by the Huinola that year. It was a terrible scandal, 1965. years went by, and the Aruyu Canoe Club eventually was persuaded to sell the Hanakioki.
And what year?
1972. And they chose to sell it to the Makahage, which was newly organized, and it was Miriam and, remember these folks, George? Miriam, Naoni? Miriam and Philip Naoni, they were the creators of this new club, which was later superseded by Fred Shee and her family. But they, on a given day, they were going to have this dedication. And Kahu was going to come down and go down. And I hauled out my previous history that I'd done years before for the Harry Field deal, delivered it personally up to Kahu's house. Now this is Kahu, the recent minister of the Kawaihao Church.
This is a kaka.
Reverend Akaka in 1972, with a special letter. This is for you to use in your dedication prayer, etc., etc. But please, this is to go personally from you to the leaders of the club, so that can go into their. I didn't attend the dedication, so I assumed all these years that he passed it on. I found out later from Miriam and Philip, you know, we say everybody wants to find out about the history, and everybody says, you know. I said, do you mean to tell me you don't have it? I did it for you, care of Kahu Akaka. We never got it. By the time I had a chance to look back at it, I've lost my record. So what I said was earlier, if the best thing I could do for you folks is to find my file that has it, at least that would give you a history, because everybody with respect to the Hanakioki that I interviewed is lucky.
Well, I think that if you go pre-Jackie Cross, which would be in the 40s, you know, 48 at least, 48 now, because I know Jackie Hughes in 19, when he became coach, up until 1953, or to 53, and then Charlie Martin came in, they use extensively only the Kahakina. Because, well, as George pointed out,
is that close
Kahakina to weighed 375 pounds.
But that closes the chapter on Hanakioki. I wanted to get that out of the way.
Okay, just a minute. Let's finish up with the Hanakioki. Do you know, do you recall how we got it or where?
Oh, yeah. I can remember some of the things, but it would be so much better if I could find my file. The Hanakioki means working George. And George refers to George Carter, who was the governor of Hawaii in those days, and it goes back to about 1907-08. Ironically, they all came from the same part of Kona. I don't know who the builder was, but I'm sure that Dr. Golly, what was his name? His son is a doctor also on campus, or the Dr. Blank. I can fill in that. But it came from Kona. It was built right there in Kailua.
Is Kailua up here again?
No, I don't know about, no, I don't know about that.
That
you know, I wish I could remember what I transcribed from my notes. And then I gave Dad another's copy.
Did you by chance submit a copy of the history for the board?
Well, you know,
records?
I could look through the minutes to see if I did. And it's conceivable that it might be in somebody else's records, but I was so mad that Kahu wouldn't do that to that. Because for years afterwards, everybody wants to know about the history of the Hanakioki.
Yeah. Yeah.
I said, hey.
He forgot about it.
You know, he must have forgotten about it. And had I had a chance to go down there, and I'd just taken a new job with my present firm, we worked on Saturdays. It was a Saturday morning deal.
Because it doesn't stop right in the 40s or the early 50s, it goes on. I mean, this is until George came. Your first Molokai with outrigger was either in the Hanakioki or the Leilani. Okay, now, and you're even 56. Here, I have right here, 1950s Leilani, George Downey, Molokai. So that meant that in 1954 and 1955, the Hanakioki was used. 1954 was that made-up team, and that's documented in our, again, our good old forecast. And it was a team of, you said some of the names,
there was some, too. There were some Marines in there.
Marines?
No. Jimmy Smith?
Yeah.
We
can document
that. Alan Woodell?
Yeah. Alan
some
Woodell.
Of those other guys.
Yeah. This is a
it was
team.
Not an official outrigger team. Because
no,
it, did
it
not
was not. But they were in the Hanakioki.
Really?
In where?
In the Molokai Channel Race. Oh, yes.
What year was that?
53.
54.
Oh, I mean, no, I'm sorry, 54, yeah.
But
the Molokai
go down.
Started in 52.
Okay.
And so the third year, Outrigger had not participated at all in the Molokai. And in the third year of the Molokai, Outrigger finally put a team in. And these, they came out of the woodwork, and they used the Hanakioki.
The first year Kleiner was
52.
Well, the first year.
Race.
No.
53?
George was in the canoe.
Oh, in the first race. But was it 53 52. Or
52? 52. 52. Molokai won it.
Okay.
52.
You guys were leading, you remember, in swamp, and nobody had covers in those days.
Like there's a picture laying around.
And the Molokai crew.
What
were
you paddling for?
He was Waikiki Sir.
Waikiki Sir. And they were a cinch winner. Obviously the best crew.
But Molokai? Because I remember us on the beach, this cool kid.
I mean, let me take you back till 1947. And 1947 is when a bunch of us guys that were surfers, practically living on Waikiki Beach, came up to July 4th canoe race that Outrigger was putting on. So amongst ourselves, we said, let's go down and enter the event. And we had no canoe, so we went down there, and I don't know exactly who we talked to, but we ended up using the Hanakioki in the July 4th race.
Is that right?
We went in this race and had a great time, came back in, and on the way back said amongst ourselves, let's start a club.
And George, who was your leader then?
Wally, for a second.
It was Wally.
Yeah. And
Was Pearl still married to Wally then?
Exactly. In fact, her daughter just came into town just the other day.
Okay. Your niece. George, then at that time, just in the back of your head, Huinalo was a club.
Huinalo was a club.
Outrigger Canoe Club was a club. All right. Huikalia?
Huikalia was...
Were they in there? Because that would have been a Kailua. Was there anybody from the...
Huikalia was not a Kailua club. Huikalia was a club that was put together by the Pang family.
Pang family. Oh,
right.
That's right. Yeah. Were they in there at that time?
Because they had a canoe called the Kaiulani.
That's right.
Okay. Joe and his brother?
Akong.
And Akong. But they were... Basically, at that time, only three canoe clubs in the race?
Well, there was one more club. There was a...
We had Honaunau, Huikalia.
Huinalo.
Outrigger. Yeah, Waikiki, which, as
well, Waikiki,
you say, that
at
was
that point, that was the beginnings.
Okay. Then you had Kolaupoko from Kailua.
Oh, Kailua. That was the Windward group.
Heilani. Heilani was... they were before Waikiki.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, okay, so that would have been three. It would have been Huinalo, Outrigger Canoe Club, and Heilani. Those would have been the three first canoe clubs. And then Waikiki, that was it.
Yeah, and that group in Kaikolaupoko, they always seem to have had people down in that Windward.
Purple
Windward
side. And yellow.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, God, it was just...
Anyway, you know, this is the story as it went, and... So one guy says, well, you know, in order for us to get involved in canoeing, we have to have a canoe. So day one went by, and the next day we started asking around, and we happened to run into Akong Pang. Akong Pang was a staunch supporter of the Outrigger, and he
member
did
of
all,
the Outrigger
did,
later on.
He did his, you know, did everything for the club around the beach and with canoes and whatnot. And he says, oh, he says, you know, he says, the guy to see is Dad Center. He says, Dad has a canoe that you guys might be interested in. So we went over to Dad's house. Dad was living right up here.
That's where Klein lives right now.
Exactly, right?
Where is that?
Right over here.
Oh.
It's 2987. It's the old Center property.
That Center had a home there. And we went up there and talked to Dad, and he told us about this canoe, and he says, in fact, he says, I got it right in the yard there. Well, we couldn't see it when we walked in because he had built a special shed, and he was able to con his wife into building this 50-foot flower to take care of her flowers, he said.
Greenhouse.
He said
wife. B-I-T-C-H.
Anyway, here was the canoe, and he kept the canoe under unbelievable conditions. And those conditions were that every time he watered the plants, he watered the canoe. So we came back to the house and looked at Dad and told him we'd like to buy the canoe. And he says, you know, he says, this canoe has been waiting.
You meant with a hose, you mean the actual hose?
No, he had a sprinkler system. He actually had a sprinkler system that he opened up and it watered all the orchids, and, you know. So he said, you know, he says, I've been waiting for somebody like you people to come along. I knew someday it would. He said, nobody likes that canoe, but it's a very good canoe. And this was the canoe de Malia.
Where did the name come from? Was it Malia when you bought it? Or did you folks name it?
No, I think we named it, but we named it after hearing him talk about how the canoe went so well in calm water. And,
yeah, let me ask you the question. Right now, you tell me exactly what that means and how it was spelled.
It was spelt with an E, and I can show you a picture of it.
I know it, and we've been saying this for years, yeah. And they put the name on the boat.
They completely changed it.
Huh?
Yeah, they completely changed the meaning.
But they didn't know.
Yeah.
Apparently they didn't know.
Well, I mentioned it to them once, but, you know, it just sort of
now,
went out in
the field. Now to interject one more time, because...
You know what we're saying?
Well, listen, I want to go back one time.
I'm going to lead up to something that's really interesting.
The word is M-A-L-I-E.
Right, I know that. You and I have discussed that.
Yeah.
We've discussed another thing, because when the three boats were purchased or received by AmFac for Dad Center, then we tried to do.
Now let me get that into that.
Okay,
this is a real interesting.
Okay,
really interesting story. So anyway, during this time, Dad let us keep the boat there, and we paid for it as we.
How much
was
did
no
you pay
payment,
for it?
Payment plan. We paid all told $3,000. And we took quite a few years to pay it. I think we took at least maybe 8 years, maybe less, I'm not sure. But there was no requirement on us. You know, if we wanted to give him $1, there was no interest. And he was very gracious about it. We always respected Dad for that. Well, anyway, we got to know Dad, and as he reminisced some stories, here's what I got from him. He said, told me this story. Dad worked for American Factors. American Factors had a very big establishment on the Kona Coast. They not only had the produce, where people came to buy canned goods, and they had oil, the fuel, they had lumber. So it was quite an establishment. Everyone became very highly indebted to AmFac, living on the island of Kona, living on that island. Dad told me that in 1935, there was a company called Takimoto Hardwoods. this company, just around 1935, was taken over by American factors for indebtedness, money owed to the company. American factors allow this company to continue, and primarily what they were doing was cutting coal for sale. Lumber, they were shipping coal out of Kona, making furniture out of it. I don't know to what extent, but it was a very lucrative business. The story I got from Dad was this, that this company, Takimoto, hired all the canoe builders, because these were people who knew where the coal was, and also they were capable of spending this time in the mountains, because everything was, you know, pretty much done by hand. There was some machinery, but there were a lot of brute force, there were a lot of muscle that was necessary. And Dad remarked to me, he says, you know, it was real fortunate that they did that. They hired canoe builders, because what happened, every time they saw a very good log, a good tree, they wouldn't cut it for lumber. They would take and knock it down and make a canoe out of it. And the relationship that they had with the owner, this Takimoto, this Japanese fella, he didn't speak against it. In other words, he supported them. So as the result, they accumulated dozens of canoes, big ones and small ones. Well, what was interesting, that one of the things that I checked on, and why all of a sudden the canoe builders starting to need work, having to shift over to working for a lumber company. Well, what was curious about it was that the land acquisition started to control the availability, private land acquisition started to control the availability of people getting these logs to make canoes. So this forced a lot of these people to building what they call the three-board canoe, where they took planking, finished planking, made out of redwood or fir, and made what became the very famous Kona fishing canoe. It was a three-board, very big bow. It was 28 foot. They put an outboard motor. No longer you paddle. You had an outboard motor on the back. And this was the Kona outrigger. It was a very famous outrigger. So I had followed that part up because I was curious. All of a sudden, you had these professional people, which were family trained into hewing out a log, shifting over, not finding work. One, the availability of the log. Two, the expense. Because now, in order to acquire a log, you have to purchase it instead of going prior to that up into the mountain and seeing a tree, knocking it down, and roughing it out, then bringing it down to the shoreline. So it was a lot of work. So you needed to be pretty much a professional, and a lot of the average person there wasn't able to afford. So anyway, these canoes were acquired, and they were being built, but nobody ordered a canoe. It's just that these canoe builders were building these canoes. When Takimoto was taken over by Amfac, Dad Center was called in to look at these canoes to see whether he had a market for it. And this is when, it was somewhere around 1935, 36, right around there, he came to the outrigger and told them about these canoes.
What year, 1935?
About 35. And
because we thought 33.
Yeah, 34 at least, yeah.
Well, the history says 33.
Could be. Well, it's that he purchased it.
From people's memories.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know. This could all go back to 29, yeah. Coming up to 33. Well,
the starting point, you might be able to pin it.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's somewhere around that, you know, 34, 35, 33, 35, as I recall, you know, this mm-hmm. is what it was. And the reason I say 35, because when we came along in 1947, and spoke of getting a canoe, he says, I've waited nearly 10 years. You see, I've waited nearly 10 years. So taking 10 backwards, 1937, so somewhere around 35, 36, 34, 35, somewhere around in that. So Dad proposed to the outriggers to buy these canoes. And what he told me was that he had offered the three canoes to the club. And the club wanted two of the best canoes. So they were able to roughly finish them up in the Big Island. They finished it up in the Big Island. And they put it through water tests, actually taking crews and racing them. And the three canoes were raced, and it ended up that the Kakina was the fastest, the second canoe was the Leilani, and the slowest canoe was the Malia. She was the slowest. So what happened was that the outrigger purchased the Kakina and the Leilani. But what had happened, a businessman as Dad was, he acquired three of the canoes.
Three other?
No, three of those canoes he had acquired from American Factors, and he ended up with the third canoe. In other words, he was hoping that Outrigger would purchase it, but Outrigger didn't purchase it, so he ended up...
He purchased all three of them,
and Outrigger bought the two from him. And yeah. Then he kept them over
here. He kept them.
But your recollection was that it did not have a name at that time?
I don't remember.
Okay, now,
that I couldn't tell you where the names came from.
Do you recollect the story? Because you have one version, and Kleiner has one, or Billy Cooker, you have one version about the naming of the canoes.
I got my version from Bob Fisher.
Yeah, and yours was that we know that Thurston was for Kakina.
It's Kakina.
Well, we know that.
Who could put up and buy...
It was kind of like a...
The club named all their canoes.
No, but it was kind of a raffle, though. Who could put up the money?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Put up the most money, selected the name, and it was Bob's recollection. Bob was a young Turk. He'd come back down. He'd gone to school in Hilo. And his story is the topping... One of the
New York Yankees.
Whose reputation for personal character will not go down in history.
As being brown.
But he had the money. And he had a girlfriend.
He had a girlfriend
named Leilani, and that's the Leilani.
Oh,
Kakina, obviously,
Thurston.
Lauren Thurston put up, and Kakina is nothing more than the name of Thurston.
We weren't sure about the Malia.
But no. The Outrigger Canoe Club had no connection with
my
house.
I heard
it had to come either from Dad himself, or, as I always heard, was that the people who bought it from Dad were the ones that named it.
Yeah, but sure,
they did name the canoe.
But they named the canoe after the fact that, you know, everything that they heard about it,
the
was
quality
that it went,
that
went real well.
Dad.
It went real well in calm water.
Yeah.
You know, this is how it was named. Yeah. It was named after
the...
Now,
Marilyn, you heard the story.
Right. No. Now, the story that I heard for naming, the Kakina is the same, but for the Leilani, the story that I was told was that it was named by Duke, and Leilani meant this, by, when he named it Leilani, he meant it was the sweetest boat in the water, and when he said sweetest, he meant fastest.
And yet it was never used.
Well, now wait a while, that's a story, and I never
heard. I heard it from
put down
Tom Arnott and from Auntie Eva.
Auntie Eva would have the least knowledge.
Least,
of all.
At least.
Absolutely the least knowledge.
Because the Leilani, up until George's time, was only used by the woman's crew.
He even never came to the club until right after the war.
And that's the truth. That I know that's
yeah,
the truth.
Yeah, they, that's right.
They
I remember
let
that.
The women's ever use the Kakina.
I remember people, they were Kakina
oh,
was the...
Oh, yes. Was Kakina was gold.
Well,
anyway,
she had the...
You have sources of information, right?
Yeah.
So the women used...
The Malia. I mean, the Leilani. They used that in 1952 and 1953. Those were... And
we'll wait back, for you, Kleiner.
That's when George's wife was paddling. That's when...
Aggie Quigg.
Aggie Quigg and, in fact, Rabbit's ex-wife, who is now...
Kainui.
Kainui. Kainui. It used to be Kainui Kekai. She was a steersman for Surf Club. And they had the battle with the outrigger in the senior women's, but they were in the Malia and the outrigger was in Leilani. And for 2 years, 52-53, Leilani was undefeated. In fact, it was the only women's crew in 1953 to be sent up to the territorial championships in Hilo. The outrigger, they didn't have any other girls' crews. And then in Charlie Martin got the girls coming out, but we'll get into that. But and then you developed all of it. But there was nothing before that. It's terrible.
Okay, so the club, the canoes came in somewhere in the late 30s. And did they start somewhere in 30?
Let me just tell you one part that no one has ever said, because they didn't get this story from Dad Center. Yeah. So what happened was American Factors, when they... when they sold these canoes to the outrigger, these canoes were not finished yet. They were, you know, roughly done. So there was a fellow by the name of Yamasaki who was working for American Factors. He was the all-around
carpenter
for the American Amfac Corporation. He sort of took care of the lumber yard. He was
in Kona.
Right, so he was hired to finish these canoes and prepare them to be raced in Kona and prepare them for shipment.
And that was before Dad bought them? Or
that was when Dad bought it. After
bought
Dad
it.
Bought it.
And, okay, when you say they were just roughed out, does that mean that they were just a shape and they?
Yeah, they were shaped. It takes all the finish work, the sanding, the putting seats on, finishing. I mean, it's really a job. Anybody who deals with core knows and understands. Like I was talking to Joe Krieg, he said, "God," he says, "you know, there's so many things happens with core wood." And you have to have, your tools have to be very sharp, and it just gets on you, you know. It's a beautiful wood,
but
it takes a lot of work.
Sculpturing tools, you know, wooden sculpturing tools.
It takes a lot of work to deal with it. So it's something that just doesn't come about, you know, overnight. It's not like the typical, this is why most people don't have the energy to deal with these kind of woods. It's because it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of preparation,
you know,
a lot of sharp tools.
George joined the club in 53 on the beach, and then he became in, what, 55 or 56, your first year of coaching?
No, I came into the club in, I worked for the beach services.
53?
About 1953.
That's when you went to Peru.
Right.
Yeah.
And
I went and checked your records.
I took over the coaching of the club in 1956.
Right after Charlie Martin.
56.
Yeah.
And I stood there for
George took
4 years.
How many years?
Oh boy.
Till 1961. I opened up the city and county beach services in May of 61. So I stood at the club till December 1960.
Yeah, because you was our mortal fan. Yeah.
December 1960.
But he took the Leilani, and he'll go back, and he'll tell you about a boat called which has nothing to do with racing, except for the fact how
get the bomb.
No, it's still
how the weight came up to 400. You know, now
down
the, now or down to, yeah. Well, up to and down to. But Koa canoes before 1953, or what year was that?
No. It was, I don't remember the exact date on this one, but what had happened was the Outrigger acquired a lot of Koa canoes. They had numerous canoes. You know, they had a canoe called Ileo. They had a canoe called Kamoi. They had a canoe called Moi Li. They had another canoe called Kakina.
It was a very old Kakina.
It was a very small, short canoe. Did I say Ileo?
Yeah, how do you spell Ileo?
E-L-E-U.
That's what I have.
And these canoes, like Klein said,
and Honaunau,
were the Honaunau. And these canoes, like Kleiner said, were not, they were used by the beach services. So when I took over the beach services in 53, we were still using these Koa canoes for taking
tourists
out, you know, and the maintenance. I remember every 3 months they had to come up and dry dock. I mean, it was like a routine. You had to bring the thing up and
huge.
In those days, the methods of repairing was like repairing a regular, you know, ocean-going boat, and caulking and whatnot. Old man Kaya, right?
Jimmy Kaya.
Jimmy Kaya was the head carpenter. And, oh, God, I remember.
Above him, Jimmy Kaya. Yeah.
Those things were just... they were mad dreams, you know. You had to keep the beach service going, you had to keep the men working, and in order for them to work, they needed a canoe. So when the canoe got out of water, you had these guys calling you up and telling you, you know, hey, when are you going to fix my canoe? Because they, you know, you'd have a different group of people that wanted certain kind of canoes, and they fell in love with it, and that was their canoe. So when they took passengers out, if they didn't have their canoe, they didn't make any money. So it was a great time.
You didn't say no to steamboat.
Oh, no, that canoe was always in good shape.
George, following up on Billy's question, did we ever find out what the weight of the boat that eventually became the Malia, what was the weight of the boat?
I think the story that probably should come and go along with this, and nobody really knows, you know, nobody's ever put it into print. And that was that when we purchased the canoe from Dad in 1947, 48, and we used this canoe, we had no concept of the weight. In other words, we never weighed the canoe, we just used it, paddled it. And it was only after about a year that we had used the canoe, the Malia, and we had come alongside of the outrigger on the beach once, and we put the canoe next to it, and just, you know, out of curiosity, four of us went over to the Kakina and lifted the Kakina up, and we nearly lifted and broke our jaws lifting the canoe up because it was so light. Well, what was very interesting was that this is then what we finally figured out, that why they didn't take the Malia. The Malia is a very heavy canoe. She was 525 or 545 pounds. And the Kakina was no more than 400 pounds. So we didn't realize, God, this canoe is moving. Especially in with just a few people, or light people, or just four men. We used to race two men foreman, this was the big, big thing. And this is why she was winning so many races. So, what
How much did the Leilani weigh?
She weighed, the Leilani was about 425, 430, around in that. Might have been a little more. The Leilani was about 480 something pounds when I first started working on it. I took out 60 pounds worth of brass out of it. 60 to 70 pounds worth of brass. Where I got it then down
to pounds of what?
Brass.
Brass. Screws and brass, you know, straps and
I remember working. I watched him.
It was just a bucket. A bucket full of just, I mean, you know, you name it, it was in it, you know, everything. But it was brass. So, we went to, at that time, a respected individual in the sport, John D. Calpico, and asked him if there was any weight limitation to canoes. And he said, no, there wasn't. And he asked us what we had in mind, and we said, well, you know, we had acquired the Malia, and we'd like to do something with the canoe, fix it, and, you know, take some of the weight off. And he remarked at the time, he says, you know, he says, be real careful, he says, because you make it too light, he says, the canoe's not going to work very well. He says, we have, years ago, built canoes out of cottonwood, and none of them worked real well. So, of course, we had a little skepticism regarding working on the Malia. She was such a choice canoe, such a beautiful log, wasn't a crack in it. So we decided, we knew weight made a lot of difference to canoes, because we had been in other sports dealing with weight, and we knew the difference. We then decided that we weren't going to touch the Malia, that we would acquire another canoe and work on that and make it as light as possible, just to show everyone that the weight had something to do with the movement of a canoe through the water.
But you were pretty close to, remember you were saying, you were pretty close to that day going back to...
Oh yeah, we had,
judge.
You know, we had just, you know, we tools were there, and we were, four of us were starting to make a decision, Rudy Choi, Woody Brown, Wally Froissart, and myself. We were just going to attack, you know, we were ready to make the salad, and we withdrew. We said, what are we doing? There's no rule, you know, we can't go ahead and take this beautiful canoe and start digging it out with no rules. So we decided on buying a canoe, which we did. We acquired the
Lanakila
from the at that time the fire department had this canoe. She was a very small canoe. She was a semi-racing canoe. She was only 34 or 35 feet long. 35, I think it was. Very short for a racing canoe. She never did anything when she went into races. So we took this canoe and made the canoe 265 pounds. Well, what happened, we invited everybody in its blessing when we brought it down. We invited everyone we could possibly think of. And this was a planned launching. And when we went down to pick up the canoe, only two people lifted it in the water, purposely. Well, it ended up that canoe went in races and won every race it went into for a whole year.
What year was that?
I don't even remember. So that's it. Must have been...
You know, you started in 47, 48, and then all of a sudden you became a power 49. By 50?
50, maybe 49 or 50. And, well, ended up, it won every race that it went into. I mean, it was a joke, you know. And this is when we finally established the fact that if your canoe was light, your canoe was worked well.
But not to take away, because the year after that, when they banded your boat, the Malia came right back, and nobody beat Surf Club for her.
Well, what happened was that once weight was established, then, you know, everyone had a basis to go on as far as working on their canoes, and it was fortunate. I was telling Kleiner, it was very fortunate that we didn't make the canoe 225 pounds, which we could. We could have made it 225 pounds, but for some reason, we decided to keep it at 265. Well, it ended up that fortunately we didn't make that canoe 225, because then the average weight of the group of canoes that we used would have been then under 400 pounds, and this would have been disastrous.
It would have ruined that.
Under what we found out later on regarding the density
in other words,
of wood.
You took all the active canoes and weighed them and struck an average.
And we took an average of all the canoes, and this is out of 400. Minimum weight came about.
Would you rather today?
But I thank God that we didn't make it and drop it down
today,
anymore, because 400, believe it or not, is the weight that the canoe can live. You know, if it goes under that, then it's going to die just a natural death because of the thinness of the hull for such a long boat and for the kind of care and the usage it's used today.
George, if you had your choice, and if we could turn the clock back, what weight would you think would be the minimum?
For the canoes, at the length that they have now, 45 feet, it'd probably have to be about somewhere around 450 pounds, you know, to just...
Well, no, even the length of the Leilani and the Malia, if you had your choice
to preserve and everything else,
would you up it?
I'd up it.
To what?
I'd take it to about 450.
Really?
That boat would live.
Yeah, then the canoe would live. They'd live a lot longer.
That's an important part of this whole thing.
I mean, this is
cool.
This is really something that, you know, most people haven't given much thought to it. Now, I'll give you an example.
I agree. I want to get that in. That's why I asked the question.
I'll give you an example. Joe, I was talking to Joe Quigg at the races, and he was telling me that for that canoe that he built, he just finished, Ka'aloa, that it is just at a point where if that canoe, he could not make that canoe longer. It's at a point now where the thinness of that hull, if no care, if care is not given, it's going to crack.
Oh yeah,
it's
because happening right now.
And this is the point that really I'm illustrating here, is that you could not take that canoe and thin that canoe out anymore, because
after each race, and I think I'll go with George, that after each race you're going to see that canoe will be on the dry dock, and it'll be repaired.
Well, it's not even in ocean races yet.
Yeah, we use it. I don't think.
Oh yeah, this is the point. See, it's not even in ocean races yet,
and it's already feeling.
So you can see the danger. Here we are, supposedly young fellas trying to progress, and we almost destroyed it. We almost destroyed the canoes.
Yeah. There are limitations. He is lucky that he came in at such a time, and he was such a craftsman. And they were lucky that they had experimented on a canoe called Lanakila, because Huinalo had destroyed a canoe, the Moy. I mean, that thing was paper thin. the White Horse being every year to keep up in competition with the Malia and the Leilani and the Kahakina. That canoe was finally this.
Two little waves.
No.
And the Malolo just wrapped, opened that thing like,
exactly,
like an orange.
Exactly. This is a...
Which canoe is that?
This would be the
Malolo.
Beautiful canoe. It's a beautiful canoe owned by Huinello. It was before the race, one of the races.
And these both canoes are what?
These guys all of a sudden were broadside to a wave. I remember
the White Horse is what, 100
like
years
a,
old?
Like a funeral.
Yeah, it must be at least that. Yeah, this was in Canecopia, right out front.
Yeah.
Out by,
and a wave just broke into the canoe. Not a big, big wave, but enough. There were guys in it. It just opened up.
Exploded.
Exploded.
Three pieces.
What we might even see, Marilyn, and this is only between this little group here, and only what I've seen this week, after two regattas, is that you are seeing a beautiful canoe, but a log that had problems in the beginning. It wasn't one of the best logs, and I guess everybody agrees that log, the Kaloa, was not one of the best logs. But what... Because of the length, that they've had to take that canoe down already. And as Joe Quick pointed out to George, is that the maintenance on a day-to-day and a race-to-race, that canoe is already, I mean, I have never seen.
I think there's a crack in, I saw a crack in it.
Oh, they were putting patches in this whole week.
See, this is
so in other words,
it's way overdue for people
overdue
to understand the... The wood has an integrity. It has a memory. And fortunately, the old Hawaiians knew the core very well. And they deliberately, when they made the canoe, like a calabash. They made the canoe very thick on the bottom and gradually relieving the pressure as they came up to the top of the gunwales. Well, you know, most people don't understand that. They don't understand that whole bell or the calabash concept. Well, basically what it does, it lets the canoe vibrate and it turns and exerts its energy out towards the top of the gunwales instead of into corners where it cannot escape, and as a result they're cracking like the canoes today. Canoes today are the inner circumference follows too much the outer circumference. And as the result, it attacks these corners along the circumference line, especially if it's not a cylinder or parabolic curve.
The
Hawaiians knew that when they made the inner part of the canoe, the inner part had a different circumference than the outer part.
The one thing they say about this canoe, and I paddled it last weekend, is that you don't feel in a normal coal canoe that I'm used to, you feel if somebody is off. You can feel the timing and stuff. In this canoe, you don't. To me, there's a problem there. That canoe is taking all that force, and it's not dispersing that.
Oh, I don't think so, Bill. I think that what it needs is it takes time for a canoe to be understood. You know, it's a special boat. It has unique characteristics. It has a personality. And once you learn that and you start to you rig it according to its personality, you balance it according to its
what
personality.
What I'm saying is give, you know?
That's
what I'm saying.
I mean, you know, if it's limber, I don't know.
If the canoe is limber, I think it's rigid, and it goes.
Uh-huh.
I'm second guessing. I think the canoe is rigid, and I think that because it is rigid, that it is starting to do these little funny things like it doesn't have the propensity to be able to throw off the little exertion here or the little exertion there that, you know, it's hard to explain.
Normally speaking, if you have something that is flexible, then you have all kind of mixed feelings about it.
That's
because
right,
it wants
yeah.
to do. But something rigid usually has a has a personality to it. What you have to do is to find out its balance, and once you find its balance, then you deal with it accordingly. Every one of these canoes have a certain personality. You rig it a certain way for certain kind of things. You know, there's no one canoe for, you know, all seasons. You rig it, and you have a rigging for all seasons, but no one canoe for all seasons. Does that make sense, Kleiner?
Well, yeah, but rigging.
Yeah, but rigging. We were talking about that today.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes plenty of sense.
In other words, you adjust your rig. You adjust your rig, but your canoe remains the same.
Okay. Now, we were. You know, I feel so good because I talked to her on the phone about the different characteristics of a canoe, and you deal with those characteristics. And the thing that I cannot stand is this phraseology used by so-called experts, such as the canoe can't turn. No, I said, when I think of that expression, the canoe can't turn, I'm thinking of a log that's got like a porpoise. It's capable of turning its nose 10 degrees to the left, and the okoli can turn it. So, and the canoe can't turn. Because it doesn't know how to do
bend its nose.
And yet, the canoe doesn't turn unless you put the right people in it, the right power in it, the right technique in it. And it doesn't, you don't do this overnight. And when you get the right people in the canoe that can't turn, it's a beautiful turner. But you have too many people. Mm-hmm. Especially with new crews, you know, God, we whipped them last week around the turn, we did do it. A canoe can't turn here. So you have that psychological thing. I said, one thing about this happens only to the average canoe crew. When you're up to your ass in canoes, you have nothing but criticism. You know, you've got this canoe and this canoe and this canoe. And it changes from season to season. 3 years, the Kakina is great because it can turn. Next year, or 2 years, it can't turn. That canoe hasn't changed one iota.
It hasn't changed.
And then the Leilani, oh, it's great. And then the Pauwa can turn. But ooh, all of a sudden the Pauwa can turn. So the best clubs, the ones that have no psychological problems,
have one canoe.
One canoe! And they make the kids go in and the big boys go in and do it like surf club for you. Hey, no problems with the canoe, right? No problems with the canoe. Only the other guy has a problem.